Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Catherine, 1st of October, brand new season, brand new day. How are you feeling?
Oh, I hate autumn.
This is the Tennis Podcast. Brought to you in association with The Telegraph. We're going to be talking about loads of tennis. There's been lots of it going on over the past week. Beijing has just started. Wuhan has ended. We've got other tournaments. We've got Bernard Tomic to talk about. We've got Arina Sabalenka, loads of stuff. We've also got Simon Briggs on the show. I spoke to him last night talking about all the politics going on at the moment, and there's a lot of it. He has been right in the thick of it. He's got lots of new things to tell you all about. So, do stay tuned. Don't ring off just when Catherine stops talking about autumn. Before we get on to anything else, Catherine, I just want to mention the fact that I didn't say this is the Tennis Podcast brought to you in association with The Telegraph and Amazon Prime Video UK, the home of the US Open in the UK. It is still the home of the US Open in the UK, but we're not brought you in association with them anymore, not at the moment anyway. That partnership has come to an end. They have been with us since Queens, which was fantastic for us, brilliant support, helped us to hire the newly graduated grad Matt until the end of the year, hence why our agenda has been so much better. Not that we keep to it, but anyway, we've bought some new podcast equipment. We're looking into the idea of maybe doing some podcasts from the O2 Arena. So just wanted to say thanks to Amazon Prime for backing us. They're welcome back anytime. And also, of course, Catherine, a big thank you to all our listeners who backed us via our Kickstarter at the end of last year and the start of this year. We've done it 2 years in a row now. We've produced, believe it or not, we have now produced nearly 100 episodes of the podcast just this year. And it's only October the 1st. How are you feeling on the back of those 100 episodes?
Quite tired. buoyed by the support. Yeah, we do have sponsors that come in and help us, and we're very grateful to that for that. They are a significant part of what we do, but the fact is it's the Kickstarter that makes it possible, that makes us know at the start of the year we're going to be able to do this thing for the year. It makes us able to make plans to make the thing as big as it can be. You can probably tell we're going to do another Kickstarter. That's the bread and butter for us. It's the support of the people that listen. It wouldn't be possible without it.
So thank you, all of you that did back us at the end of last year. And as Catherine says, December the 1st, we're going to be hopefully getting some more support for you to produce the show again in 2019, weekly throughout the year, daily at all the Grand Slams. We managed to, I don't quite know how, but keep it up daily throughout the Slams all the way through this year. And as I said, we're always looking to see if there's maybe extra things we can add on. We've done the Queen shows. We're going to look at the O2 as well to see whether that might be possible. Also, now, Catherine, last week we were talking all about the Laver Cup, and one of the things that you said on the show, and something that I definitely agreed with to a certain extent, was about whether the Laver Cup was for the real tennis nerd, the real tennis fan, maybe our tennis podcast listeners, people that really love the tennis, or whether it was for more casual fans or more general sports fans that could just sort of dial into that particular event. That has really caused a bit of reaction from our listeners. We've had a lot of response. A lot of people have written very politely to say that, look, I just don't agree with you, that either I was in the stadium or I was watching on the TV. I consider myself a tennis fan, as much of a tennis nerd as either one of you, and I loved it. And I thought, there's just one email that we've received. You can write to us via our tennis podcast website if you'd like to send a longer message than just the confines of a tweet. And that's exactly what Sally Wells has done. And I just think this email sums everything up, really, in terms of the feeling out there among quite a few of our listeners. Sally says, "Hi, Catherine. I guess I'm not part of this. I feel moved to challenge your assertion that the Laver Cup is only for the casual tennis supporter. Anyone who knows me is aware that I am the real deal when it comes to tennis nerdism. I probably share a common ancestor with student/graduate Matt and was stalking the exits of London tennis tournaments begging for reusable tickets when even David was in nappies. So I am part of this. I've not only listened to every one of your podcasts, that's 469, by the way, but I've listened to many more than once. I follow the tour, men's and women's, all year round, online if I can't get it on TV, with family holidays and birthdays having to be planned around key tournaments, and I love the Laver Cup. It is hugely entertaining, shows a side of the players and captains that we don't normally see, often a more playful and humorous side than they can let out usually. It's great to see the interactions between the older and younger players, and while I could happily live my life without the chest beating of Jack Sock, it's great to see the skills of fabulous doubles players on show while the greats of the singles court flounder around. It doesn't need to be taken hugely seriously as a tournament. It's a fun addition to the calendar. I enjoy the variety of the short matches, long tie breaks, and mix and match of doubles and singles. There's so much regular tennis, and you can often talk of the rigours and arduous nature of the tour and the impact it can have on the mental health of players. It seems to me that all involved find it a refreshing change, a reminder of the fun of the game and friendships that I imagine can only be beneficial in the context of the pressured and peripatetic, am I saying that right? Peripatetic life they live. I say, long live the Laver Cup, and I plan to be in Geneva next year to watch it. Love the podcast, by the way. Sally."
That is one of the best emails we've ever received. It's an absolutely brilliant email, and I'm completely persuaded by it. We've had others along the lines of correcting me about it being, you know, not for the nerdy tennis fan, and I think quite possibly I got that wrong.
Just blame Sarah Wollandar, good friend.
Yeah, I think maybe to revise what I said a bit. I think maybe one of the biggest pulls of it, the biggest strengths of it, is that I think still it will pull in the more casual tennis fan. I still think that the point which was made to me originally by Sarah Willand about the fact that if you stumbled across it as a casual tennis fan on the TV, it probably would grab your attention, catch your eye, and make you hover on that channel when you perhaps weren't intending to. So I still think it has a power to pull in a casual tennis fan in a way that perhaps some other more traditionally meaningful tournaments don't. But yeah, I think perhaps or certainly definitely I got it wrong to say that it's, you know, it's not for the nerdy tennis fan. I think Sally kind of does that thing of expressing what was in my head better than I did myself, which is which is pretty good, you know, just making the point that you don't need to ram the meaning of it all down our throat for us to all appreciate it and say this has a place in the tennis world. You know, it has a place as it is, regardless of whether it evolves into being something anything like the Ryder Cup of tennis. Now, we've all just enjoyed the Ryder Cup, one of the most scintillating sporting weekends imaginable. And if there's anybody out there that's just watched the last 3 days of Ryder Cup and is still willing to put their hand up and say the Laver Cup is the Ryder Cup of tennis, then I mean, I'd love to hear how they're defending that, because it's just not. But it might be one day. I've no idea. It might be one day. It is not now. I don't appreciate being told that it is, being sold something that I don't think. But it still has a place in the tennis. It doesn't need to be taken hugely seriously as a tournament to be a fun addition to the calendar. All the points that Sally makes about the mental health of players, etc., all really valid. It has a place. I support its existence. Just don't tell me it's something that it's not.
Hmm. Very well said, Catherine. And the good news is, if you are struggling for summing up your own thoughts, I've got Sally's email here, so I'll pass it on to you.
Yeah, email address. Sally, Sally might be getting ideas about starting her own tennis podcast.
She better not.
And I'd probably listen. She's used the word peripatetic in an email.
Yeah, I can't say it, but now I know what it is, and afterwards I'm going to look up what it means. So, Catherine and Sally are the new tennis podcast hosts, because they understand how to say that word.
Hey.
I don't. Thanks for your email, Sally. Fantastic to hear from you and really interesting. Now, on the subject of the place in the calendar for things like the Laver Cup, it brings us on to the wider discussion of the Davis Cup, tennis politics in general. And I mentioned at the outset of this show that I'd been speaking to Simon Briggs last night, the Telegraph's tennis correspondent, who was out in Chicago to cover the lead up to the Laver Cup and to bring some of the stories from behind the scenes. He's also had an opportunity this week to talk to Wimbledon's Philip Brook, who is the chairman of the tournament and is very influential in the fabric of the game. And just fascinating on the politics of the game at the moment. But first of all, Simon also got a chance to speak to Roger Federer while he was over in Chicago. So what does Federer make of all the politics at the moment? Where does he stand?
Yeah, I mean, he certainly said that he wanted to speak to Novak and Rafa and create a kind of unified position among the leading players in the sport so that they could have their voice heard. But it's a tricky one, because he's certainly got skin in the game, as the phrase goes now. He's not really an impartial actor anymore, because for him, you know, this is his brainchild. It's been really successful. It's got off the ground really quickly. So for him, he's got a lot invested in it, which I think will mean that he will be more reluctant to maybe to back the Davis Cup in its new incarnation than he might otherwise be, particularly as, you know, the Cosmos team have maybe, I don't know if this is ill-advised or not, but they certainly made a beeline to try and grab that week, 2 weeks after the US Open, as the potential finals week for the new Davis Cup. And that was a pretty good way of making sure that they were going to get off on the wrong foot with Roger, I would have thought.
Yes, yeah, I think you're right there. Now, since then, you've returned from Chicago. We've had word come through that the Davis Cup Finals is going to be taking place in 2019 and 2020 in Madrid. No great surprise, I don't think, given the Cosmos group is from Spain and led by Gerard Piqué. It's going to be held in La Calle Mágica, the magic box where they hold the big tournament in Madrid. What are your views of that as a venue? And also, I mean, I think one of the things that has wound a lot of people up, certainly doesn't sit well with me, is the fact that there are wild cards at all. Those wild cards have been given to Britain and Argentina. What are your thoughts about that?
As for the Calle Mágica, or I'm not saying it very well in my Spanish accent, which is non-existent, but it's an unusual venue. It has a lot of seats down at court level, which are sponsor or corporate seats, and they're very well respected and known for the way that they treat their corporate guests. It's to the point where Wimbledon sent people off to, look at the model out there, because it was so renowned as being the best in the world. Having said that, sometimes those seats are quite empty and it can feel a little bit without atmosphere during the Madrid Masters, but that might not be a problem in this instance, because I imagine, you know, it's obviously a 3-day event rather than a week long, and they might be able to fill them and keep. I think they'll probably work very hard to make sure those courtside seats are filled, and you don't get that sort of slightly tumbleweed atmosphere that can develop sometimes in Madrid. So I think it'll be successful as a venue, more successful perhaps than it might be during the Madrid Masters. And I've forgotten what the second question was.
The wild card issue. The wild card. Does it bother you at all?
Well, I think, you know, in the context of what's going on, it's so far down the list of concerns, really, that I haven't got myself worked up about it yet. I mean, let's be clear that the big concern is, you know, this potential head-to-head clash between a Davis Cup finals happening in the third week of November and a World Team Cup happening in the first week of January, which could begin, you know, in the next 15 months or so. So that's very much number one in my list of concerns. Whether the Davis Cup is cheating, in inverted commas, by sort of breaking the impartiality of the system, well, I guess this year they slightly avoided too much criticism by sort of picking Great Britain and Argentina on the basis that they were the last two teams to win the event who weren't seeded and also have a strong travelling support. But it's very interesting they didn't pick Switzerland, and I'm sure they would have done if they'd had any indication that Roger was going to play, but I'm pretty sure that he's not going to, and that's why they didn't. So again, yeah, the politics is right there, front and centre in the decision-making of what, you know, might be considered to be an impartial kind of level playing field that you might expect for such a famous event.
Now, in recent months, Simon, I think you've alluded to it there, that the issue of the potential Davis Cup followed by an immediate World Team Cup, and you've also got the Laver Cup. So where on earth do we stand? And everybody's been planting their feet and grabbing their territory within that calendar. It seems to me, having heard some of the quotes of David Haggerty last week, that there's some thawing of relations, or at least public utterances are such that they seem to be giving themselves a bit of license to compromise here. And I know you've also spoken to the chief executive of Wimbledon this week, Philip Brook, and it seemed to me that he was saying something along those lines as well. What's your take?
Well, definitely I'm hearing there are more talks, you know, more quite important talks going to happen this week. You know, the level of sort of frustration between the players is quite high, in the sense of there's a sense in which people don't really trust each other at the top there and don't necessarily feel that, I mean, the viewpoints are quite, they're coming from very different places. So there's some way to go before you're going to get everybody on the same page. And I think behind the scene, there's been quite a lot of, you know, fairly, what's the word, accusatory sort of fingers pointed across the boardrooms. Wimbledon certainly were very unhappy with Tennis Australia's investment in the Laver Cup and in the World Team Cup. And Phil Brook, when he spoke to him last week, he spoke quite a lot about the politics at the moment. He said that the level of tensions were greater than he had ever seen in 20 years of working, you know, at the heart of the sport. Unfortunately, he didn't have any room to put that in the paper because ended up writing about Serena Williams again. But it was quite a revealing quote. He said that there is a natural order to the sport, in our view. And he said, call us old-fashioned, but at Wimbledon, we quite like most of the natural order that we had. And I was saying to him, part of this issue is that you've got competing bodies, and there's an element in which commerce, you know, in this situation, is going to pit body against body, however much you try and talk about the good of the sport. You've got rival interests, and if one becomes more successful, it naturally almost takes limelight from the others. So it's very difficult to see how the structure can give us a sort of Benthamite greatest good for the greatest number type solution, because you're all pulling in different directions. And, you know, he kind of came up with that line about the natural order, but ultimately he also raised the question of a commissioner, whether he said, some people say, you know, we should have a tennis commissioner, but basically we wouldn't want to do what we were told. I mean, he raised it, and then he said, well, you know, maybe we should be talking about it, but I can't see us wanting to give power to a third party and just take instruction from them. I can't see it happening. So he raised it, but he also said that he didn't see how it could work.
Mm. He also talked about the on-court coaching issue, which I remember back to their spring press conference, I think back in early May, when Richard Lewis was absolutely categoric that Wimbledon had no intention of allowing on-court coaching or coaching of any type. In fact, he said that they would like to enforce it more. And obviously this has become a very significant talking point in light of the US Open women's final. Was there a change of tack at all? I mean, again, it seemed from reading your piece that there might, and some of the other pieces, that there might be some room for manoeuvre there.
Yeah, I think possibly that some of the things that Phil said were maybe, I mean, it was reported that he was interested in the commissioner, and yes and no. I mean, he said that he'd like to see it explored, but he couldn't really see it working. So he raised it with one hand and sort of knocked it down with the other. In terms of coaching, I think it was pretty clear that they haven't changed their position, and it's very hard to see them changing their position. The only thing he was saying, I think, is if every other party in the world is united, then I guess we might have to look at whether we give way. But I don't think he sees that happening. He still thinks that the French Open, or the French Tennis Federation, agree with Wimbledon. And he what he did say is that there's going to be a meeting, he thinks, before the Australian Open, at which the stakeholders try and thrash out a unified position. And he's pointing out that technically the WTA on-court coaching system is a trial. That's the basis on which it's been approved, because the rules of tennis still say you can't have coaching during matches. And it's been a trial that's been going on for 8 years. And so, as he put it, when does the trial cease to be a trial? You know, it's just been kind of a de facto reality that has grown up. But where is the evidence proving the benefit of this stuff? You know, ultimately, there is two arguments for bringing in coaching. One is that it's going to add an extra level of interest. I mean, we've all seen that there have been moments when that's happened on the women's tour, but it doesn't seem to be systematically the case, does it? And secondly, the other argument would be that it's unenforceable to stop people doing it. But again, I mean, it's not a great rule, is it? You know, you can't stop people smuggling stuff through customs, so, you know, get rid of border checks. I mean, it's sort of, that doesn't sound like a convincing position either. So I think he feels that it's not going to be an easy sell for the people who come, if that meeting happens, as he says it will, before January. It's not going to be an easy sell for the people who come saying, yes, let's give the green light to coaching.
Mm. And where do you think we'll end up in terms of talks around the Davis Cup and the World Team Cup? Do you think there's a chance that the World Team Cup might not happen, or that they might throw in together between now and this time next year, and when that all starts to come into view?
I think there's definite chance. Yeah, I think we shouldn't give up hope for that. You know, talking to some people who are high up, they still feel that we're, let's say, at the low point of what's been a turbulent year, and they still feel that by the end of the year, people will have seen sense. So that's quite an optimistic reading, particularly as I've been talking about the way that the game necessarily creates conflict between its rival partners. But, you know, there's a lot of people out there who still think it's going to happen. It's a bit like Brexit, isn't it? You're waiting for sense to prevail over the madder elements of the political setup, and hoping that you're not going to be left with no deal. There's still plenty of action going on behind the scenes. It's almost more a case of whether people who've, let's say, built up a certain amount of distrust and dislike, even I might go so far as to say, are prepared to sort of swallow the bury the hatchet. That's the phrase I'm looking for, not swallow the hatchet, bury the hatchet, and work together.
Mm. We watch with interest. Anything else of interest to report, Simon? What have you got coming up?
Well, it's a quiet 2 or 3 weeks, and then, I mean, it's not quiet for the world of tennis, but I'm not going to Asia. My pal Stuart Fraser is going to Shanghai from the Times. I'm going to probably go to Paris, and we'll be trying to pick up some interviews there for the Telegraph supplement that's going to run ahead of the ATP finals in London.
Excellent, excellent. Simon, travel well. Lovely to have you with us here on the Tennis Podcast as always.
Thank you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
So Simon Briggs here with us on the Tennis Podcast. Catherine, fascinating insight, isn't it, into the kind of conversations that are going on behind the scenes at the moment. And I mentioned the David Haggerty element. He'd spoken to Russell Fuller from the BBC, in which he was certainly talking about not wanting to go out on their own. And there's been a lot of that already, of course, but it feels to me as though these big players in the game are now starting to row back and realise they need each other. They need to come together to some degree and find a way of this all to fit. Because at the moment, you've got so many moving parts, Laver Cupping thrown into that mix as well with the ATP World Team Cup proposal, which is due to start early on in 2020, the Davis Cup finals, which are now at the end of 2019. And they've got to figure out a way to just make this thing work.
Yeah, I mean, as Simon said, the comparisons with Brexit are extraordinary, aren't they? It's almost like everyone has to become fully acquainted with, fully and horrifyingly acquainted with the worst case scenario before getting acts together and putting egos and agendas and interests. Other interests to one side for some sort of greater good. It will never be the absolute greater good, because I don't think it can be, but it's something resembling it. No one's shying away, are they, from sort of fronting up about how bad it's got relations wise and Simon certainly wasn't shying away from telling us about it there. It's all, you know what, it is all so complicated by the fact that you have got the likes of, you know, Federer and two of the Grand Slams invested in the Laver Cup. And, you know, there are so many compromised and conflicting interests going on, but it doesn't mean that they can't try to put it all aside and reach some sort of situation that will in the end be best for tennis. And I think I don't want to keep harping on about the Ryder Cup because this is not the golf podcast, but I mean, what better crash down to earth can there be for all the currently existing team competitions or proposed team competitions than to have the Ryder Cup having just happened and showing us that none of what we currently have, Davis Cup included in its current form, potentially its proposed form, are that or anything even close to that. And that's what we're all aiming for. And it's, you know, I think it's a reminder that there can be nothing better. That I mean, they've nailed converting an individual sport into team competition, haven't they? Would anyone have changed, apart from American people, would anyone have changed anything about the Ryder Cup over the last 3 days, David?
The only other thing I can think of is the fact that it doesn't bring in other countries from around the world, and there's a huge amounts of the world that can't necessarily be, well, certainly partisan about it, because Australia and Asia and all those sort of countries and continents are not involved. So, but that's why I think the Davis Cup is so important to tennis, because if there's a way to harness everything that's good in the Ryder Cup and make it the Davis Cup, which is properly worldwide, imagine what you could end up with for tennis. And I'm an optimist, Catherine. I think that we can get there, I certainly hope so, because it would be the best result for everybody.
Yeah, it'd be great if you could take money out of the equation altogether, wouldn't it? I mean,
yeah, good luck with that.
I mean the decision to host the choose the Kaya Magica is the in Madrid as the venue for the Davis Cup, that worries me a bit. That worries me.
I think it can be a decent venue if it's got enough people making a lot of noise and caring for enough of the matches. It's just one massive
big
question.
But of all the venue, of all the major venues on the tour, that is the one that has one of the worst track records of exactly what you've just said. Great crowds creating a great atmosphere.
I agree, but they have a year to get this right now and to advertise it and to make sure that people know exactly where it is, exactly what they have to do to go and see their countries.
They've been doing that with the Madrid Masters for,
but it's not the same
as a decade now,
as supporting your country. It's like the World Cup.
It's not, but I've seen Nadal play there to not, I mean, look, the atmosphere is better when Nadal plays, but it's not what you'd hope for, Nadal playing in.
It wouldn't be my number one choice.
I don't want to do that event down. There is lots of great about it. The people that run it is run brilliantly, but I do think there is something fundamentally missing about that venue, particularly if what you're explicitly looking for is a great atmosphere, which unquestionably it is with the Davis Cup.
Yes.
That is one of the things that's missing from it. And speaking to people in Madrid, that I do. Do you think there's an issue fundamentally with the location of that venue and the difficulty of people getting to it from Madrid? I don't know. I really hope it pans out. But have they picked it because they think that's the very best venue option, or have they picked it because Gerard Piqué's calling the shots?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't know whether you noticed that. I think you might have just called it the Davis Cup for a second there, which is...
Did I actually?
Magnificent, if you did.
Have I, in a Freudian way, come up with the solution?
Brilliant.
There you go, guys.
Incidentally,
The Davis World Team Cup.
Yeah. as a reason for one of the reasons for my optimism over it is because I remember what happened when the Grand Slam Cup run by the ITF used to exist. And it was a 16-player event at the end of the year. I think it was in December. And just an obscene amount of money available for the winners of it. Greg Rozetsky won it 1 year, I think. Peter Korda won it 1 year. And you had that, and you also had the ATP Finals still, or the Tennis Masters Cup as it was known. Eventually, they realised, to use the words of Chris Kermode, it was insane to have two of these competitions in such close proximity. And they merged them, effectively, and they both had a stake. And we now have what we have at the O2. So,
scale of 1 to 10, David, how much do you think Chris Kermode is regretting that particular choice of words?
See, I, knowing Chris as I do, I just think that is him all over. He says how he feels. And yes,
yeah, but he said that he thought it'd be insane and then proceeded with plans of insanity.
No, look, but that's not going to be solely his doing. He's going to have been forced into a position, but at the same time, it gives me hope that that's the clear position of the man. You know, he's not going to sit there and pretend that everything about the proposals as they stand are great just because the players have basically voted for that. That's why I think we'll end up with a compromise that ultimately works. I hope, anyway. So that's
Optimist Law.
Yeah, that's the politics.
Like Optimus Prime.
Yes.
Optimist Law. Do you see what I've done there?
I do. Thanks for that.
That was actually off the cuff. I'm quite pleased with it.
Yeah. All right. Great. Can we talk about other tennis now, not politics?
Yes.
Can we start with Wuhan?
Yeah.
Because I really enjoyed Wuhan. I was commentating on Wuhan last week for BT Sport, and it was really, I mean, at the start of the tournament, we were still getting people screenshotting empty stadiums and putting them online, and it was all a bit depressing. And yeah, I saw some matches where you're just thinking, this is just not how it should be. And then it started to change. The first time I saw it change was during the match involving Wang Qiang, who ultimately got to the semi-finals, sadly had to pull out with an injury, but she's made great strides, really good player, good mover, just does everything well. And when she came into the stadium, suddenly there was a crowd, and it was really loud. But then it wasn't just for her match. You started to realise as the week went along, crowds were much better. It does appear that part of the reason for that is that they've built and improved the tram system to get to the stadium. They've also got a shopping mall in the area now, so I guess it becomes more of a destination to go generally. And they've just got an atmosphere. It's not there yet. It's still an enormous stadium, but it gives you hope that actually this tournament has a future as a place with an atmosphere, and that's really important. And the final, Aryna Sabalenka beating Annette Kontaveit 6-3, 6-3. Well, first of all, it was really quiet. There was a lot of people in there. There were thousands in the stadium. And the performance of Sabalenka, I know you've talked about it quite a lot here on the podcast, and others have as well. I think this week is the first time I've really just sat there and taken it all in about what this woman is about. And I was blown away, Catherine. This player, and you could tell talking to Joe Jury, who was the person I was commentating with, she does not need any persuading at all. This is a player, alongside Naomi Osaka, that I could see ruling this sport for years to come. She's immense. She does everything well, and in a frightening way. Both her power, her attitude, her intent, her appetite for the game. I don't think I've seen a player with this sort of appetite to just compete and play the sport and just take people on for a long time. I mean, and I hate doing this. I hate comparing female players to male players, but I was trying to come up with a female player equivalent as a comparison, but it was almost Nadal-like, this sheer appetite for the game. I don't know. What do you think?
Oh, I think she's awesome. I think she's absolutely fierce, and I love watching her play. It's, you know, I know it's lazy to do these what if things, but let's remember that she lost out to Naomi Osaka 7-6 in the third. In the third round of the US Open. And that was the only match, scoreline wise, if you look at Osaka's run, where Osaka was even remotely challenged. She double faulted on match point, Sabalenka did in that match. It was toe to toe, incredibly close. She had come in as the New Haven champion, but for a couple of points in that tiebreak, it could very easily have been Sabalenka that won the US Open title. It could have been. She's good enough already, I think, to be winning Grand Slams. And if if the one question mark, and it doesn't mean she doesn't have it, it's just not yet quite proven, I don't think, in Asaka. If there is one question mark over her, and you've mentioned it a couple of times, David, it might be that appetite for the relentlessness that it requires to stay at the top of the game and be a multiple Grand Slam champion. Well, I mean, what's the opposite of a question mark, David? A full stop. There is absolutely no question mark at all over that in Sabalenka. I just think she's the coolest. I mean, Osaka's very, very cool as well, but I do you remember when the WTA did their Strong is Beautiful campaign, and I despaired every day for for the year that the campaign ran, David, and was very boring about how much I hated it, because I could see what they were trying to do. It was just so misconceived. They were trying to get away from the, you know, the aesthetics are everything in women's sport thing, but it was so misconceived, because actually it suggests that the ultimate measurement is still beauty, that you're converting strength into beauty points, and that is just beyond missing the point. Well, I mean, everything about Sabalenka is strength, and I just think that is the coolest. I think she's great. And
there was a wonderful little clip just, I think, at the end of the semi-final where she was asked, or it was put to her, you seem to be fearless. Is that true? And she goes, yeah. She just, there was no sort of modesty about it at all, overt, false modesty. This was just how she feels. She loves the game. She has this appetite for it. And there's a great interview on the WTA website with Dmitry Tursunov, her coach, former top 20 player in his own right. And he's a cool cat as well. He is not somebody who is just he's the perfect kind of foil for her, because there's no point in trying to push Sabalenka anymore. She doesn't need any pushing. It just comes from within. But he knows how to just slightly direct, it seems to me, and take some of the pressure off her during the matches. He was cracking jokes, making a laugh in the on-court coaching. He actually said that he thinks she could be somebody that changes the way the game is played, or the way it's viewed in terms of her approach. And he actually compared her to people like Serena and Seles and Graf. I mean, look, these are all-time greats, and she hasn't actually won anything yet. I think we've got to say that. But you could imagine her being a massive impact on this game for years to come.
Yeah, and it's a very watchable style, isn't it? She has this incredible power, which she seems to produce with absolute ease, but she doesn't deploy it all the time. She's very controlled and reserved with regards to the application of the power. She's not afraid to come to the net. Her volleys can still improve, but she's comfortable there, and she's a better volleyer than most on WTA Tour. I mean, that is an area that it seems to really have just dropped off in women's tennis, which I find such a surprise. On paper, I would have thought it would be a tactic that would pay a lot of dividends in a lot of matchups, but it seems to have been neglected over the years. But not for her. She's determined to have a very complete game, and I so respect that about her. I love to interview her. I think she's, I mean, can you imagine the sport having her and Osaka at the top tussling away for Grand Slam titles with, you know, with Halep and Wozniacki and the rest of them there as well. But I think a rivalry between those two at the top, I mean, I just can't, what could be better? I just think that's brilliant.
That would do. Incidentally, Sabalenka and Osaka are four of the female players, 21 and under, currently inside the world's top 20 with Kasatkina and Ostapenko. And eight of the Grand Slam champions are under 30 at the moment on the WTA side, whereas on the men's side, there are no current Grand Slam champions on the planet under the age of 30, because Marin Cilic has just turned 30 and Juan Martín Del Potro, I think he has as well, hasn't he? Just amazing to think that.
Yeah, yeah. And what the average age of them is 30, 33, something like that, 32, 33. Obviously, Roger Federer is bringing that up considerably. Yeah, I mean, what a stark contrast. Mm. What a stark contrast. I mean, you can make arguments that each of those two you can make arguments that people have made arguments that the dominance still of Federer, Nadal and Djokovic is a sign of the weakness of the generation coming through, and whereas the WTA is in the opposite situation, the generation coming through really are doing it, but you could argue that the supposed stars of the sport aren't doing it in the way you do. So I don't know, I sort of don't want to get into which is a good thing and which is a bad thing.
No, it is what it is. So it anyway, is what it is, yeah. Tashkent has also taken place this week. The couple of notables, really. Anastasia Potapova was in the final. I think wasn't she a junior Wimbledon champion? Or she was?
Yes.
So that's quite a result for her. But actually, I'd rather draw attention really to the player that beat her in the final, Margarita Gasparian, who's a tall Russian player with a dramatic, flowing single-handed backhand, but who has just had the worst time of things the last couple of years. She's had three knee surgeries in 2016 and 2017, and she told the WTA insider, Courtney Nguyen, that if the third of those knee surgeries hadn't worked, she was prepared to quit the sport. So I think that's just really great to see that she's a ranking of 299 in the world, 24 years of age, and has come back and won that title. I saw the moment she won the title, her opponent actually double faulted, and it wasn't a sort of celebration. Oh, thank goodness you've double faulted. She just dropped her racket on the floor and just, you know, disintegrated into tears. You could see what that moment meant to her. And so congratulations to Margarita Gasparian. Nice story. Talking of comebacks, Catherine, Bernard Tomic has won Chengdu 7-6 in the third and final set, having saved match points in the second round. He then saved four match points against Fabio Fognini in the final as well. First title in 3 years. And honestly, I'd almost forgotten about Bernard Tomic, to be honest. It's like I'd wiped the hard drive of my memory from mentions of him, because he's not felt like a tennis player in such a long time. And I just love the fact that he has quietly worked his way back. He's qualified for this tournament. He's won it. I don't know what it will lead to, but he gets such a hard time. And a lot of it has been self-inflicted. He's frankly been a prize idiot at times in his career. But I also think he's been really badly looked after generally in his upbringing as a tennis player. One misstep to another, a lot of them are his own fault. I'm not trying to excuse his behavior, but I just feel that it's just become this massive pile on with him, and I'm pleased that he's managed to dig his way out and start to try to make something of his career, whatever that might be. This is a great moment for him.
Yeah, and look at the way he celebrated it. I was actually quite choked up watching him celebrate that win, because he's been someone that a bit like Kyrgios really has, you know, made out a fair bit over the years. I think it's fair to say that he's not too fussed about tennis, that he's, you know, if he'll do it, he'll make a decent living. He's referenced the money he makes from tennis more than once in quite a crass way, hasn't he? But he's not really bothered. You know, he's a bit too cool for it all. And like with Kyrgios, I think that's all front. I think he cares a lot more than he wants to let on. I think it's all maybe a defence mechanism. And I think that those turbulent times in his tennis upbringing are largely, you know, I can understand why he has a lot of front and a lot of defense mechanisms going on, because I know there comes a time as an adult where you, regardless of what you've been through, you have to take responsibility for your actions and your decisions, and he's behaved appallingly. He's done several things that are, you know, we can't excuse. However, that doesn't mean you completely discard the various motivations for how people behave. It still bears referencing and remembering. And I think he's been lost. He's like a lost little kid, isn't he? And if you don't have anyone decent advising you, how are you supposed to find your way? You know, last time Bernard Tomic registered on my radar was when he was going into Australian I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here.
Yes.
And I just thought, all right, okay, that is not the behaviour of somebody that is giving any hoots at all about their tennis career. And then if you haven't seen his celebration winning the title in Chengdu, check it out on YouTube or Tennis TV or whatever it might be, because that's all the evidence that you need that this matters to this guy. And I hope that he can... Look, I'm not going to be putting him in my predictions to reach any Grand Slam quarterfinals again. Do you remember when I did that?
I do, yeah. US Open about four years ago.
I'm not going to get carried away, but maybe if he can just channel it into something that he can be proud of in 10, 15, 20 years' time, you know?
Yes, and that's very well said.
Yeah.
That's what it is. It's about getting the best out of yourself so that you're happy with it and that you can eventually stop playing and think, yes, I turned it around. I did what I could. You know, everybody makes missteps and some worse than others. And I do think some good people have tried to help him in the past and he's thrown it back in their faces. But look, that happens too. And good for him that he's found his way on this occasion. Let's hope there's some more to come. ATP Shenzhen tournament. Lots went on there. Yoshihito Nishioka beat Pierre-Hugues Hubert in the final. 6-4 in the final set of that final. It's his first title. He suffered a bad knee injury last year. He was 380 in the world in April, was Nishioka. So fantastic job done from him. He saved match points against Shapovalov in the second round. Also, Cameron Norrie had a good win over there in Shenzhen over Borna Coric. Andy Murray beat David Goffin. That was a decent result, but eventually lost to Fernando Verdasco. Murray then cited an ankle injury for pulling out of Beijing this week. So that's Murray's season over with. He will now put in 2 or 3 months of hard graft to try and get ready for the new season. And a little bit of British news here in Shenzhen as well for Joe Salisbury, 26 years of age, who won his first ATP title in the doubles alongside Ben McLaughlin. He reached the Wimbledon semis earlier this year, did Joe. He was ranked outside the top 200 18 months ago. Now he's in the top 40. So well done to him. And just a quick word on Shenzhen, I mentioned Verdasco. This clip of Verdasco giving short shrifts to a ball kid and actually trying to get him to hurry up and being quite demonstrative, and it didn't look very nice what he was doing. There's been a clip going around social media. Everybody has had their say on it and really given him a big hard time over it. What was your take when you saw it, and what do you make of it all?
Well, it's horrible. It's the reaction of the little ball kid that's just so desperately trying to do a good... I wish the ball kid had just gone, thrown the towel back at him and gone, all right, hold your own sweaty towel. But he's so desperate to do a good job and his little face nodding and going, okay, Fernando, I'm imposing my own words on this. Okay, Fernando, I'll do better next time. You know, I'm so, so sorry. Really distressed me. Imagine if that was your child.
Yeah,
being
I tell you,
shouted
I'd have struggled not to come out of the crowd. To
yeah,
be honest,
absolutely.
If that had been my kid.
His big moment on centre court. You know, look, he's not the only or necessarily the worst offender. We've seen it before. Novak Djokovic has done it. Others have done it too. I mean, I remember Djokovic because he ended up doing a big apology afterwards, didn't he? Verdasco might end up doing the same because this has been so pounced upon on social media. So I feel a tiny iota of sympathy for him because he is the scapegoat for a wider problem that's been building up, but so easily solved. Don't have a towel rail at the back, which is what they're trialling at the next gen finals, isn't it?
It is,
just take that responsibility away from ball kids. It's not officially in their job description anyway. It's just evolved over time. And the players now expect that to be part of the services that the ball kids provide to them. Just brief all the ball kids that when the towel is chucked at them, they just let it fall at their feet. You know, it's so easily solved. It's such a bad look for tennis. It's gross. It's absolutely gross.
Well, I think this will probably be just another little element that ends up changing that rule. And so, let's hope that's the case. I agree with what you've been saying, incidentally. I do have that very small bit of sympathy for Dasko, in as much as, he behaved really appallingly and everybody's had a go at him. And, I mean, my experience of him, he's always been an absolute gent in situations that I've had dealings with him in the past, and I'm not saying that makes this okay or anything like that, but you know, he has been made the scapegoat, but let's hope that the result of it is that the rule is changed and it stops happening. Serena Williams is out for the rest of the season. That's fourth year in a row that she's made the US Open her final tournament of the year. Not hugely surprised, to be quite honest. Simona Halep has retired mid-match against Ons Jabeur with a continuing back problem. So, and I tell you, there's a lot of the WTA players at the moment pulling out of matches. I mean, the Daria Kasatkina I saw withdrew from a match. It's such a long season, isn't it? And we say it all the time, but you can see it. And that's why Sabalenka is so dangerous now. Fascinating matchup for Sabalenka against Garbiñe Muguruza tomorrow. And there is a chance, if Sabalenka were to win that match, she could still get to Singapore. Imagine that. Imagine if she went crashing into the Singapore draw.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't, and you also wouldn't, I mean, that's a sort of getting there on right, but you wouldn't bet against it. A couple of those that do end up qualifying for Singapore ending up having to withdraw.
True,
so
yeah.
She could end up sort of comfortably getting in, couldn't she? I mean, Halep's a really tough one, because I don't know if you saw the comments that she made. She said that she was really psyched. A lot of people you see with withdrawals and sort of everyone, a lot of people just limping through this portion of the season, whether it's, you know, the Americans that don't particularly enjoy the travel to the Far East and the, you know, or whether it's the not having a Grand Slam to aim for, the carrot and stick thing, whatever the reasons. You see a lot of sort of not quite as fired up players as you might otherwise see at this portion of the season. Simona Halep said, "I was completely fired up for this last bit of the season." She said she was back on the practice court second week of the US Open after having lost in the first round, desperately, you know, trying to get herself in tip-top shape. And then she just felt her back go last week. And it sounds like she, rather than sort of thinking, okay, well, you know, if I'm not able to do my best this time of year, then whatever, at least I've got some time to get myself right for next year. It sounds like she was really gutted because she felt like she was in a position to do something. Maybe in Singapore, hey, she could still do that. But it sounded like she was pretty gutted with putting her back out. So, yeah, we'll see. But, I mean, I think Sabalenka might end up squeezing in there due to, I don't know who it'll be, but I'd be surprised if there wasn't a withdrawal or two. So I think, I think maybe better than 50-50 chances.
Oh, I think she's got a big...
I think you're a bit better acquainted with the numbers than I am.
Put it this way, she has to have a big run in Beijing, which means she has to beat Muguruza. There's no chance of it happening unless she goes and beats Muguruza. I mean, she's 10th.
I think she will beat Muguruza.
Ooh.
Don't you?
Well, that's tomorrow. By the time we all listen to this, we'll know.
Out-of-date tennis results news.
Yeah, we love all that.
What, you saying you're backing Muguruza to beat Sabalenka?
No, I'm not. I mean,
is anyone?
Well,
I mean, Garcia did it last year.
Muguruza won today
comfortably. The Wuhan-Beijing double qualifying for Singapore. There's precedent.
Very interesting. Very interesting. We watch with interest. Catherine, anything else?
No.
Right. Well, you go and see other dogs that you can find this week. What was it, Eskimo, you were pictured with? What was that dog?
Eskimo the Pomeranian. I have to say, beautiful-looking dog. Not necessarily the most sort of human-friendly or animal-friendly or friendly full-stop dog I've ever had the pleasure of acquainting myself with.
Oh, well, he looks pretty happy to see you.
He photographs well.
He did photograph as well. Yes, yes. Okay. Well, anyway, Catherine will meet further dogs over the course of the week, and we'll let you know how that goes. And we will be back with another tennis podcast next week. We have been executive produced by Melanie Bowes, Triple S, and TennisBalls.com. Our mascot, aside from Rosie, who's getting very jealous about all this mascot chat about other dogs and whatever, is Charlie the Ferret. And we are, of course, sponsored by the Manga Club. And we'll be back next week. See you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.